Good morning. We're going to continue our study and discovery of case 23 in the Gateless Gate. And today I want to share with you a little bit different translation by Koan Yamada, 20th century Zen teacher. Think neither good nor evil. The case. The sixth patriarch was once pursued by the monk Ming as far as Mount Taiyu. The patriarch, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the faith. How can it be competed for by force? I will allow you to take it away." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Terrified and trembling with awe, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please reveal it to me." The patriarch said, "At the very moment you were chasing after me, without thinking good or evil, what was the primal face of Monk Ming?" In that instant, Ming suddenly attained deep realization, and his whole body was covered with sweat. In tears, he bowed and said, "Besides the secret words and secret meaning you have just revealed to me, is there anything else deeper yet?" The patriarch said, "What I have now preached to you is no secret at all. If you reflect on your own true face, the secret will be found within yourself." Ming said, "Though I have been at Huang Mei with the other monks, I have never realized what my true self is. Now, thanks to your instruction, I know it is like a man who drinks water and knows for himself whether it is cold or warm. Now you, lay brother, are my master." Patriarch said, "If that is the way you feel, let us both have Huang Mei for our master. Be mindful and hold fast to what you have realized." Mumon's commentary. It should be said of the sixth patriarch that his actions sprang from urgent circumstances. His kindness is like that of a grandmother who peels a fresh lychee, removes the seed, and puts it into your mouth, so that all you have to do is swallow it. The verse. It can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be sufficiently praised. Stop trying to grasp it with your head. There is nowhere to hide the primal face. Even when the world is destroyed, it is indestructible. When I read this translation, many things leapt off the page for me. But the one that I want to offer an opportunity for us to look into together this morning is this idea of the secret that Ming asks of our sixth patriarch, Hui Nong. And for me, what's come up around this is the ideas and beliefs that we can have about the Dharma. The same kinds of thoughts and ideas that Monk Ming had. That the Dharma is hidden, That's it. There's a secret to finding it, or a secret to seeing it. If only the teachers would speak plainly and directly, then I could understand. Then I would be able to see it, find it. If only I could have a big spiritual awakening experience the way Monk Ming did, then I'd feel worthy as a Zen practitioner. Then I'd feel worthy as a human being. These ideas about the Dharma being hidden, being a secret, something to look into. And this word secret, as I was reflecting on this, things that we hide from others immediately came to mind. We keep it a secret. A birthday party, a surprise birthday party, or other things that we humans tend to keep secret. And something else came to my mind too, which was brought forth by something else that Koan Yamada says in his commentary about the secret, about what I hide from myself, what we can hide from each other and from ourselves. Alan, in his encouragement talk last night, offered the word masks that we can wear and do wear, and also set down. And I think this is how I hide myself from the outside world. But as I look into this, I hide myself from myself sometimes. Denying my own anger, denying my own confusion, denying my own broken heart. And Sesshin for me has been a great everything. Not just this session, but every single one that I have been on. And one of the secrets that it has exposed for me, each time I am here, is how deeply embarrassed I am to be human. I'm embarrassed at how long it takes me to brush my teeth, and how embarrassed I am that I need to go get drinks of water as often as I do, although we are highly encouraged to do so. I can't seem to move as fast as some other people, and I wish I could. But I kept this secret from myself for a long time, and it was only here at Sesshin that I saw this secret revealed. So, much to look into in this case 23. Thank you.
Just the book. Thank you. So I'm going to continue where Dharma holder Laura left off, looking maybe from a couple of other angles at this secret that our poor monk Ming and all of us here think needs to be revealed. And the thing that strikes me, because when Laura and I talked about what we were going to talk about, she had this idea about explicating this, which she just did so lovingly and beautifully and revealingly, the idea that there are any secrets at all, that we can pretend to be something other than we are. Somehow, when Laura was talking, I flashed back on an experience that I had years and years ago. Maybe it was like 35 or 38 years ago. David and I were first together. We'd been together for a few years, and I decided to throw him a surprise birthday party. But to make the surprise birthday party happen, I had to get all our friends to our apartment without him knowing. And we had a great plan. One of our friends was going to take him for a walk and take him away from the apartment. And then all the other friends, and in those days we were, most of us didn't have cars, actually, most of our friends. So everyone would walk over to our apartment and be waiting there for him and spring out and say, "Happy birthday!" And it seemed like such a great idea, because I love surprises. And I didn't know David well enough then. We'd only been together a few years. And I learned from this experience that not everyone loves surprises. And of course, the plan didn't work because David was suspicious. Because he knew me well enough, and I know this now, that I have a real hard time holding back and not being genuine in my facial expressions. I've been told this, that if I'm dissatisfied, I look dissatisfied, and if I'm happy, I look happy. And I try to pretend otherwise, but it doesn't work. And so he suspected something was up, but he didn't know what it was, because it wasn't, this party wasn't happening on his birthday, because that would have ruined the surprise. It was just an ordinary day around the time of his birthday. And the friend came late, as I recall, and I tried to hustle them out of the house, and then I got a phone call from somebody who didn't know where the house was, so I had to go out and help them find it. And I went outside, and there was the friend who was lost coming down the street, and there were David and the other friend going up the street. And I said to the lost friend, "Oh, hey, nice to see you. Wow, what are you doing in our neighborhood?" And David was really confused. And eventually, we all pulled it together, shouted happy birthday, and he was not happy. David also has a hard time hiding behind a mask. This lesson in throwing a surprise party, so please don't throw any surprise parties for David, especially now, because, you know, it could be the end of everything. Not wise to do that to those of us who are of a certain age, or vintage, as you might say. The thing that I learned, and that I kept learning over and over again as I walked through my life, just like Laura, trying to pretend, and I suspect just like many of you, trying to pretend that I could pretend, that everything wasn't already obvious, obviously revealed. And when I encountered the teachings of Zen directly from my first teacher, I started to understand this on a Dharma level. And recently I came across a lovely quote in a book by Heejin Kim, who's one of the great scholars of Dogen, our 13th century ancestor. You've got to realize that Wu Men, who collected the Gateless Gate collection, was a contemporary of Dogen's. They were both on the planet at the same time, one in China, one in Japan. Even though Dogen went to China, it's very unlikely that he met Wu Men. They probably didn't travel in the same circles. But so much was similar in their approach, even though Dogen was the great interpreter of Chinese Soto and giving it to Japan, and Wu Men was a great Rinzai teacher. This idea of the secret was apparently important to both of them. And Dogen, according to Heejin Kim, Dogen's favorite saying was "henkai fuzozo," which means nothing in the whole world is ever concealed. Nothing in the whole world is ever concealed. This is a very important point around this delusion that I think everyone I've ever met on the Zen path carries about enlightenment. That enlightenment looks and feels and smells like all these stories that we've heard. And those of us who've had the opportunity to read the Three Pillars of Zen, where there are enlightenment stories, even worse, these seeds of something glorious getting planted. The issue is, of course, that the gloriousness that people discover is that what's been here the whole time is the very thing we've been seeking. Nothing in the whole world is ever concealed. Everything is right here offering itself to us freely. And we think that what's offering itself to us freely couldn't be the awakened heart, because we have an idea of what it should be like. So our bad moods, well, that couldn't be the awakened heart. Our anger, our frustration, our sadness, our fear. I just have to get rid of that and show up as this other being. And I hope you can hear how connected this is to what Laura was just saying. It's not just us and our personalities that are consistently and constantly being revealed. It's the whole world of the Buddha Dharma constantly revealing itself as everything. And there are no exceptions to this. None whatsoever. Going to the bathroom, being constipated, having diarrhea. These are full manifestations of the Buddha Dharma. We would like to think that in the future, when we have had our great enlightenment experience, maybe we will have poops that smell like flowers. That sounds ridiculous, right? But that's the level of ridiculousness. I will not have my human life anymore. And so when Monk Ming, this earnest guy, just one of the regular guys in the Sangha, but who had this history of being really persistent, and we know he was really persistent, asks this question, this beautiful question. Besides the secret words and secret meaning you have just revealed to me, is there anything else deeper yet? And that in itself is a koan. So something happened. He experienced something. The world revealed itself to him. And then he wonders, is there more? And as one of you pointed out the other day, this is a wonderful demonstration of how the learning in this practice never ends. I hope that when you had your awakening experience, or if you haven't noticed it or don't remember it, when you have another one in the future, that you also ask, is there more? Because the answer to that is, there is. Everything is revealing itself so much more and more and more and more that there's no end to this. And Hui Neng, our wonderful sixth ancestor, says, what I have now preached to you is no secret at all. And he might even say, there are no secrets. Nothing whatsoever is ever hidden. Everything is right here. And then, of course, Ming's great line, which we quote so often, I know it's like a person who drinks water and knows directly whether it's cold or warm. I know what it's like to sit on the toilet. I know what it's like to have food enter my mouth and taste the salt and the sour and the sweet and the umami. I know these things for myself. Could this be the awakened heart that I've been looking for all my life? Yes. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. And people behind the fireplace, we're going to stop saying this after today. and move to another place if you'd like to see better. And we invite your
earnest, confused questions and comments. Yes, keep it.
So my immediate and visceral response to just the last couple of things that you said was, it's been explained to me before, I still don't get this. How can I view the angry tweets from the White House as part of the awakened heart?
Good question.
So the world appears as we think it should be and appears as we think it should not be. And there is kindness and there is cruelty. And there is generosity and there is pernicious narcissism. And that is the whole world. There is not some world where everything, where our shit smells like flowers. Even if you eat flowers, I'm told. But so what we encounter, the tweets or someone who says something that deeply wounds us or does something, what we encounter is life itself in the flame of anger, in the flame of confusion. And so our practice is not to try to get to a place where there's no flame. The flame will go out at some point, right? We call it death. But so how do we work with what arises? And the first teaching is to be where you are. Loris gave this beautiful demonstration of, I don't like this. So it's not that we act from that place. So we're not saying, whatever you feel, just let it out. But we're saying, whatever it is, just let it be. And then that fire burns you up and does something. And then you decide, all right, what can I do? What do I love? Where do I turn my attention? So this is life, and there is no end to, fortunately, what comes.
Debbie, the other thing that I've had to come to terms with is that anger, that meanness, that pettiness, I can find that right here. It's in my heart. I can find it toward the people who are doing the tweeting, right? But I can find it. And that doesn't mean it's okay. And it doesn't mean that I don't stand up and say, no, this is wrong. But it means that I can do it, I hope, with a tiny fraction more of a sense of, brother, I get this. And it makes me terribly sad for all of us that this is part of human life.
And one more thing about that, maybe not one more thing, who knows. In general, and not just about the tweets, when we cut out the parts that we don't like, our world gets narrower and narrower and narrower, and we live a very, very restricted life. And this practice is about opening, becoming more and more spacious. Thank you so much.
It seems to me that the abbot of the temple was encouraging exactly that. I mean, he knew what his monks were like. He knew that they were going to be angry.
Yeah.
He knew he was going to set them off. And he created a secret. And it's kind of almost staged, except in a way he just kind of let them go. So I had the feeling like he loved this group of people who were, greedy, angry, and ignorant. He loved them. And they were a fractious group, like it seems to me all groups are. And And he was able to create this secret. Someone came in and gave him the opportunity. And he kind of knew that Monk Ming, it feels like, was going to go out. And maybe, in a way, he wanted to see what would happen. You know, that maybe this would be an opening for everyone somehow. Mm-hmm. So I wonder what you think of that.
It's funny, a lot of the koans that we encounter create, I don't know about you, but for me, can often create this cognitive dissonance inside myself. So much of our practice creates places of discomfort. And it's like our koan tradition is asking us to step into perspectives and roles that that make us uncomfortable from time to time. And that can happen here too. I'd rather be doing something else, but instead, you know, I'm going to sit on my cushion. I'd rather fold my napkin in a different way at Orioki, but I have to do it the way you all do it. So there's this thing about kind of bowing, you know, to, and it's interesting too, because, so there's a place to bow and there's a place to stand up, and Ming gets up and he decides, I'm not going to bow, at least initially. So not that there's always a particular course of action that we always have to take, but, you know, I love these stories because it's us, like we get thrown into, you know, dissonance, and that happens in Sangha too. We like to think that Sangha is this place where there's not going to be any dissonance and, you know, everybody's going to always be getting things exactly the way they want it. It's not, you know? Yeah, there's conflict here, and so we can practice encountering it the way we can encounter ourselves on the cushion.
I just wanted to add on to that. I was thinking about one of the lines in the story when Wei Nong says something along the lines of, hold fast to what you have realized. Mm. And so Wei Nong holds the teacher. Yeah, Wei Nong, our sixth bishop. No, his teacher, sorry. I don't know his teacher's name.
Wang Mei.
Wang Mei, thank you. He holds fast to what he has realized. That this is the person, Wei Nong is the person that is going to be, that is his Dharma heir. Right? He had been maybe thinking something else. But the stories I have read about it, he questions Wei Nong extensively and sternly. And he's really poking because he wants to really be sure. He doesn't take it lightly. Because I think you're right. He knows what's going to happen. Of course he does. That's why he spirits him away. You know? But he holds fast to what he has realized, and he holds this what is self-evident. So his truth, he knows, and this is what he does, in spite of the consequences. And sometimes we're, as Mike points out, we're put in these positions too, where we must hold fast to what we know is true for us. Right? And it's not easy. No one said it would be. Right? But and then as a teacher, I think there's a teaching here that he's offering to the Sangha, all of them, to say, this is it too. The anger, the confusion, the what do you mean you gave it to him? You know, the all of it. The running after, the everyone getting so exhausted, they fall away, all except for Ming. Right? It's all there. It's all it.
I want to maybe put in a good word for chasing after the secret.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Can you hear?
I kind of accidentally ended up in Zen. I didn't even know I was, you know, looking for anything in particular. And I really appreciate what you said, Melissa, about what you find is, I forget exactly how you put it, but basically you're opening up your life. You're including much more. And so I vacillate between, like, is there a secret that I'm supposed to be chasing? Or, you know, I don't even know if I'm supposed, you know, I'm not chasing. No, really, I'm not chasing, you know. But over the years, even though all I found is me, and it's much better than, like, that's much better than I thought it would.
Yeah.
So there is something to it. And maybe it goes back to the, even though we're already enlightened, there is value in the effort and the practice and the intention.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, this story is Wei Nung's story, right? So it's derived from the thing that he or one of his followers wrote, the Platform Sutra. And remember the guy, the other guy, the Dharma holder who wrote that other poem.
Right.
And in his poem, I think his name was Shen Shu, and he founded his own line of Zen. You know, and he's the one who talks about gradual cultivation. And we read that wonderful text this morning from Chinul about gradual and gradual cultivation and sudden enlightenment. You know, so here's Wei Nung promoting sudden enlightenment. Shen Shu's saying, no, polish the mirror, get the dust off. Without that, there are some teachers who emphasize sudden enlightenment. And then they neglect to tell people that you gotta keep going. It's that keeping going, right? Or you keep going, and then you get a sort of like, oh, it's been me all along, and it's not bad. Hey, it's not. I'm not so bad. This is the enlightened version of Mike Cerrone, demonstrating himself, right? And it looks like you, and it feels like you, and it talks like you. It doesn't talk like some, superhuman god, although maybe it does. It's the superhuman god version we call Mike's realm. So this is unbelievable. It's unbelievable when we look at ourselves, and just like Libby said, it's also unbelievable when we look outward and see other people. How could we be surrounded by Buddhas? And part of, I think, the practice we're doing here is, I like the word realization rather than enlightenment, because we're actually realizing something that's been there the whole, or we wake up to something that's been there the whole time. And there is a difference. At first, we believe our delusions. And you know, that I loved what Laura said, you know, maybe the teachers could just be more clear. And you know, if only they just let us know the secret, come on. And like we're saying it all the time, but do you believe it? It's unbelievable. So why would you ever believe it? And then suddenly you taste a grain of rice, and you really taste it without any interference, and it's like, oh, that must be what they were talking about. And then the mind goes, oh, so now I better get to Doksan quick and tell them about the rice. And, you know, anyway. Right. So on and on it goes. Gradual cultivation. Sudden moments of, oh, yeah.
And reminders.
Yeah. Totally. And Mike reminded me that there may be people in the back.
There's one question.
Great.
What struck me was the I have to swallow the lychee. And what's sort of mysterious or hidden or whatever is, how do you do it? Because you know it's going to be automatic. If you just put something in your mouth, it's going to swallow it down. But it's still hidden. It's still a, what did you call it? Secret. Calling it a secret. How to get that lychee down the throat.
Can I just, first of all, I think you're pointing also, like Michael was, that this, and David in his talk yesterday, this idea of intention, this idea of I think there is a kind of cultivation of intention as well, and it's a refining of our intention. that goes on, and it may start, you know, I'm going to get enlightened. That's my intention. That's fine. That's a great intention for all beings. And it may shift and refine and become less and less verbal over time and whatnot, or whatever. But this refinement and care around our intention while we're here, I think actually is a very important part of our practice, not to be neglected, you know? And so for that monk in the moment, it was about clearing the mirror. And that is of value. That's beautiful. For someone else, it might be realizing secret practices. What is my secret practice? What do I hide from myself that I don't know that I'm doing while I'm here? Starting to realize it and wake up. So, you know, it's not always the same for all of us, and there's not one right directive. But there's also the side of it that we sometimes talk to that is about that we are actually just receiving. So, the side of it that is that the lychee is being put in our mouth all the time. We don't have to do that part. So there's a lot of intention that is just meeting what's already happening.
And I love, James Ford was fond of saying that realization is an accident. Swallowing that lychee is an accident, but this practice makes us more accident prone.
Yeah, we saw Craig's hand before, and then we'll go to whoever's back there.
Yeah. I'm thinking about the teaching to hold on to your realization and wondering why that's not a kind of attachment. Mm-hmm. Whenever I get a glimpse of something that seems real and try to hold on to it, I find myself naming it. Becomes an abstraction. I'm rehearsing what I'm going to say and talk something about this realization. In prison, it's an artifice.
Yeah. Can I? Yeah. So, my view on this. Thank you for pointing that out, because it can be that way for us, and it can become a problem because we want it to be that way again, and we pursue that, and we try to make it be that and stay that way. And of course, we've learned that nothing stays that way. Right? Nothing stays. And so the way that I hear this is, know that this is a resource for you. Know that when the water is muddy, know that the bottom is still there, because you have seen it. You have seen it when it was clear for you. Because we have clarity and then we have confusion. Clarity and confusion, in and out, was narrow and wide, and we don't stay the same ever, moment to moment, right? So this knowing something for ourselves, that we see something and we go, oh, this is self-evident. I see this, right? And when I forget, right, I can turn there. Right. So for me, this is about entrusting. And it's interesting to me that in this reading of the koan, that Wei Nung says, this robe is the faith. Okay? This robe is the faith. And I hear that as one way we can hear that is, this is entrusting ourselves to this great oneness, this great universe and us that is constantly manifesting as F. It's Jigyo.
Jigyo.
What struck me yesterday and today is that the whole structure of the story, as Melissa pointed out yesterday, it's makeup. When I heard this story a long time ago, I felt like, wow, great story. But somehow I disappointed yesterday because contest for Dharma, become the Dharma holder, it's a contest.
It's a, like, wow, it's very interesting. And one person should be real. Wow. There's a competing. There's competition. And then teacher helped him to run away. And all the rest of the monk start running. And there's one person who win the game and got the point. Number one. Wow. You know, somehow the I don't know who wrote the stories, but they know how human mind exactly works. I am the one in the game, and I will get that, what I call it, enlightenment or encountering God. I have to win that game. I will be sit long in this room, and I will be the first one.
And you know, there are some Zen teachers who promote that. I mean, not just Wang Mei or Hung Ren, I think is his actual name.
What if one monk fell down on the way, get the wainer, and he had his head on the ground, and he enlightened? Wow, I got it! It's not in the story.
But it's another good story. So, you know, somebody said the other day, I don't remember who it was, that, you know, we think that we'll get enlightenment and then people will throw a parade for us. There are places where at certain Zen centers, I don't know if this still happens, where if you had a Kensho, there'd be a parade for you in the Zendo. Promoting this very kind of thing. And going back to Carol's point, you know, you have to wonder, maybe the skillful means, right? That, because as Jagel said, as you're saying, whoever made up the story really knows how human minds work. And we are all narcissists on some level, and we think that we are the center of the universe and that everything revolves around us. I've learned that it doesn't, at least in my life. If I ever thought it did, certainly if I had things the way I wanted them, things would be quite different right now. But there are many stories also in the past, many koan stories of Zen masters making trouble. You know, just like Hung Ren did. He the contest? What? You know, come on, and you better go after him. What? And we hear these stories all the time. And they are, I think, if we take a step back from them, Zen teachers, part of the job description is that we are troublemakers. We are not meditation teachers. We're not helping people to be calmer, more mindful. I have a lot of experience with trying to help people to be more mindful. And ultimately, what we're helping people to do is to wake up. Right? Sometimes you're not mindful. Sometimes you're not calm. And that is the Buddha nature, once again, manifesting itself. So we will do things and say things every once in a while intentionally that are troublesome. Right? We certainly make mistakes because we're human and we say things and do things that are upsetting. But it's not about being nice. It's much more important than that. Right? A lot's at stake here. The world is at stake. So I agree with Carol.
And this is a story, and one of, I think, the root stories of the Zen tradition. But this was written by Wei Nung's followers to bolster their claim to legitimacy. So this is a story about fighting, created by people who were fighting over the Dharma. To bolster, well, we are, so our teacher, well, how come we never heard about him? Who did he study with? Oh, he studied in secret with this great other. We know this guy's legitimate, but, well, what was he doing for 5 years? Well, he was in the forest. He was cultivating his awakening. We are the true inheritors. So there have constantly been struggles in Zen as a cultural phenomena. Who is the emperor's advisor? I used to think it was wonderful. Imagine if the President of the United States were a Zen practitioner, well, then there would just be, who's the top advisor? Is it Boundless Way or is it Great Vow? Mm-hmm. Well, it's Boundless Way because we have, you know, clearly we have. And this is human nature. And Zen is not, we cannot escape from that. So how do we see it? How do we touch the truth of this story that is more than historical? Mm-hmm. Right? This speaks to us all. For me, this has been such a resonant story for decades. You know, I just love Ming. Because, you know, he's so wrong and he keeps going. And I think, I'm just wrong all the time, but I can keep going. I'm a stubborn fellow. So these stories touch something in us. The danger of this single transmission. There is not a single unbroken line of transmission except the breathing in and out. Right? These are stories, and whether you're officially transmitted or recognized, so there's some value in it, but if we hold too tightly to it, then we're just falling into the other trap, and then we're doing an exclusive club, and so, you know, what does David think about me? Well, he really likes me, that actually, well, I'm talking about myself here. there's something more important than Zen.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something more important than whatever form we have. So the retreat is wonderful. I so love, such a great opportunity. And it's just a temporary, skillful means. If we hold on to this too tightly, we get in trouble. If we say it doesn't exist and everything's okay, we get into trouble. And we're going to get into trouble whatever we do. So we do our best, and we embody whatever form we have and play the role. I'm chopping the apples, and chopping the apples is the full enlightenment. You have been chosen. You are the chosen one to chop the apples. At last, the realization of all your dreams.
So,
yeah.
On that note,
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great. Teach you a little bit.